Blog Talk Radio.
Never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few. I hope, indeed I pray, that we shall not be found unworthy of our victory if after toil and tribulation it is granted to us. For the rest, we have to gain the victory. That is our task.
Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duty, and so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its commonwealths last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour.
We shall not fail or falter, we shall not weaken or tire. Neither the sudden shock of battle nor the long-drawn trials of vigilance and exertion will wear us down. Give us the tools, and we will finish the job.
We shall go on to the end. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender.
Across the airways. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is the East Anglian's EDL radio show, broadcasting live on blogtalkradio.com and East Anglian's EDL radio show, the official English Defence League's radio station. And tonight, we got on the co-host of the show this evening is a dear friend of ours, Vlad Tepes. Welcome, Vlad. Good to see you back, brother.
Well, thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to be on with you. Always.
Yes, it's as I say, it's always great to have have a chat and about the different news stories that's going out there. And that does seem to be, it's been a very busy week this week, isn't it, with news that's been coming out of Egypt, etc. Unbelievable.
My goodness, unbelievable. And actually, I actually prepared a couple of things. with your permission, may I play a little? I uploaded a clip because it was just so hard to believe. Hear this clip. I should explain what it is, though. So what your listeners may or may not know is that there was an attempted terrorist attack on Canada Day, like our official national day is July 1st, right?
Yeah.
And a couple of converts to Islam tried to blow up the legislature in the province of British Columbia, which is our most leftist and the most, the farthest west province that we have. I've never even been there. I've been close, but it's beautiful and it's very hippie-ish, In fact, like Vancouver Island is where all the American draft dodgers went in the 60s to go open bakeries and stuff. I mean, it's that kind of a place. So a couple of converts to Islam tried to blow up the legislature, and they made pressure cooker bombs, and they filled them with rusty nails. I don't know why they had to be rusty. I guess it's not enough that they have to kill you. They have to, make you get tetanus, too, or something. I don't really get it. But it was I guess it sounds more evil.
The thing, isn't it?
It's just unbelievable. Anyway, so I heard about this, and I was quite anxious to hear the press conference that the RCMP, which is Canada's federal police, I guess it's kind of like the FBI, except that the RCMP kind of dress cooler, and they did this press conference to announce what they knew about, and it was the press conference itself was exactly what I expected it to be, which is a fairly low level of information, mostly self-congratulatory and mostly reassuring the public that they were never in any danger, which is basically what every press conference, whenever they catch terrorists, it all sounds the same. So typically the interesting thing is during the question and answer for the media, right? So at the end of the press conference, they took a certain number of questions, and I edited out the French ones, and I basically just put in the interesting questions, and I'd like you all to listen to this. Now I lined it up so I had it exactly ready.
Okay.
Oh, come on. Now, where did I put it? Oh, here we go.
Okay,
right. Listen to Paul Weston. Here we go. Ready? And here we go.
Okay, we have another question.
Hi, Deanie Moore, the Canadian Press.
Can you speak up a little bit, please?
Deanie Moore with the Canadian Press. You mentioned an Al-Qaeda ideology, and I'm just wondering if you can explain what was the impetus for the attack. Are you talking about people of the Islamic faith, or what's the tie there?
Well, our investigation revealed that these individuals were inspired by Al-Qaeda ideology. But there is no evidence to indicate that these individuals had the support or were acting at the direction of a terrorist group, per se.
What was the impetus for the attack, then?
Again, this is a very complex issue when we talk about radicalization to violence, when individuals self-radicalize to violence. This is, I guess in this context, the significance of this investigation is that, A, it involved domestic attack planning, but that it also involved individuals that were radicalized to violence, self-radicalized to violence.
But
so
do you know,
another question now?
But just to try and clarify, though.
As just mentioned, that during our investigation, we were able to determine that these individuals were inspired by Al-Qaeda ideology.
Next question. Can you see your name, please?
Jeremy Hainsworth with the Associated Press. Is there any indication that this is a copycat of the Boston Marathon situation?
There is no evidence or information to indicate that this investigation is linked to the Boston attack. Thank you.
And is this tied at all to environmental issues in British Columbia?
No.
Just a quick follow-up. You mentioned they were arrested in Abbotsford. Is that where they live?
No. Both accused live in Surrey, British Columbia.
Jason Proctor with CBC. Just to be sort of a bit more specific or clear, when you say inspired by Al-Qaeda ideology, do you mean violence for a religious end, or is it towards the end of some other cause?
So when I refer to radicalized or self-radicalized with respect to Al-Qaeda ideology, it is radicalized to violence, so taking violent acts with a specific ideology in place.
So would the ideology in this case have something to do other than religion?
In this case here, the ideology had to do with a criminal act, wanting to pursue criminal acts on behalf of an organization that they obviously believed in, and that organization and the ideology behind that organization, as you know it, is the Al-Qaeda ideology.
What do you think of that? What did you think of that?
It's the way
It was anti-information. It was like particles and antiparticles, right? Like you have an electron, and the antimatter equivalent is like a positron. And if you put an electron and a positron together, they cancel each other out in a puff of energy. And I guess that's what the RCMP are doing. It's anti-information. If you were to put it together with what is obvious and true, I guess they're hoping it just cancels it all out, right? I mean, was that circus?
It's quite obvious that was like type of a misinformation. Well, telling you what it is, but trying to guard it from what it really is. That it was an attempted jihadist attack sponsored by the Al-Qaeda. There's pressure cooker bombs, which is in the Al-Qaeda's bomb-making equipment book, and they beat around the bush. Well, they just say what it is, or are they not allowed to in a politically correct world that we live in? They've got to sort of beat around the bush a bit. Bit like what the Muslims do to us all the time, you know, the,
well,
the dance
do.
That they do.
I actually do want to go there. I want to speculate on this because I think what we saw was such obvious chicanery, was such obvious misdirection, misinformation, and it was actually kind of clumsy, but it was consistent. So you know that it's a directive. You know it's policy, right?
Yes.
It's like if somebody keeps telling you, yeah, but is the sky blue? Like, well, you know, all I can tell you is, and then the great moment is when somebody says, one woman asked the question, was this an environmental? Was this an environmental? No. So, okay, so when you ask about something other than Islam, you get a direct answer, right? Like if that woman had asked that question. So, and that was interesting, right? So in other words, these people aren't stupid. And by the way, I should mention that to get into the RCMP, at least this is the way it used to be. Maybe you're not allowed to be like that anymore. It's discriminating against stupid people. But it used to be that to get to the RCMP, you had to like have an IQ of at least like 110, 115, 120. Like it's an elite police force. So we know. Unless things have changed dramatically. We know these people are not stupid. And again, when someone said, is this the consequence, is this an act by, you know, an environmental extremist group, the guy said no immediately. And you could have said, was this like a Catholic group? I'm sure he would have said no. And you could have done the, you know, process of elimination and got back to Islam, and he would say, well, we blah blah blah. Okay, so why? The question is begged. Why are they handling it this way? Why are they saying? Well, I have a couple of different ideas. And I think one of them is, it's one of the guys, I just sort of put this on my blog, went back and forth with a few of my commenters on this, and there's a fellow named Red who's writes geopolitically brilliant comments, and the way he sort of parsed it and put it back to us on my site was that it's kind of like the mafia when they... The mafia might hand up a little fish to the police, so the police get like their victory, and it won't threaten the operation. Well, in this case, the mafia or the Muslim Brotherhood inspired, Al Qaeda inspired mosques and organizations all across Canada, which is most of them, and the mission is trying to, you know, Islamize Canada, to get more concessions to Islam, to get rid of freedom of speech, to make it more, you know, to terraform it in an Islamic way, the Canadian landscape, right?
Yeah.
So that's the mission. So what do they do? They take a couple of loser converts that were planning to do some kind of thing. Now, they were going to a mosque all the time. And, you know, yes, as you pointed out already, the directions for these bombs are in the Al-Qaeda magazine, which you can get online. I'm not going to say which magazine because, you know,
yeah,
whatever.
I think
somebody
everybody
really
knows anyway. It's out of the domain, isn't it?
I don't want to be part of that.
No.
So some blogs do, and I think it's great. Like, there's some blogs that are good friends of mine, and I respect to the end of the earth that they republish that because they feel people need to know what Al-Qaeda is saying and what they're teaching. And I kind of think, yeah, it's true, and at the same time, I don't want to do it. But anyway, so they read this magazine, the Al-Qaeda magazine, and that's where the directions for the pressure cooker are. And, you know, now this, what it is, which is what, you know, I'm sure everybody already knows, is what Mohammed called small cell jihad, where you have one or two people that independently do and Al-Qaeda is very clear about this, they want people doing it, because small cell jihad is a much better chance of being successful than some operation with 30 people where 10 of them are police officers, right? So
yeah,
this was a classic example of what Al-Qaeda is asking its followers to do, small cell jihad. But so why were they caught? Well, I have to go back to what David Wood said. Not why were they caught so much, but why are the RCMP being so cagey and so coy about it? I have to go back to what David Wood said. David Wood said on our show, right, like a month ago, whatever, David Wood specifically said that he knew a guy who was a major Islamic supremacist that wanted a caliphate, that wanted to replace American constitutional individual rights and constitutional law with Islam and Sharia law, and he wanted that. He said these jihadis that are letting off bombs and so on, they're actually slowing the process down, so he turns them in himself because he wants to see this caliphate happen, and the best way to do it is by stealth, because every time they let a bomb go, more people wake up to what the real meaning of Islam is. Okay, so I happen to think that that was a very profound admission by that guy, and that's why I bring it up almost every show, because it's relevant. And I think what happened was, I think that the mosque or somebody associated with the mosque gave up these two guys for that exact reason. They're doing so well in Canada. They have government schools where the government gives like $5, $6, $7 million per school a year for these Islamic schools, which are total madrasas. Boys and girls are separate. Girls have to wear the head covering. The boys learn all about how to, you know, about genocide and killing all the Jews and all the stuff that Islam teaches. They're getting paid for it by the community. They're doing so well. They're making such progress in our country. You see every month here, you notice a greater number of women wearing more severe Islamic garb and same men with multiple wives, or what sure appears like walking around with multiple wives. I mean, you're seeing more and more evidence of an Islamified country and greater. Mind you, we did get rid of Section 13, the hate speech code. I'll come back to that. So, you know, it's not all victories across the board for them, but you're definitely seeing more of them and more evidence of Islamic presence and halal and so on and so on. Okay, great. But I think what happened was they gave these guys up because on the condition that they wouldn't, that the police would not associate them with Islam. Because the whole reason they gave these guys up was because they knew that if they were successful, that another 4% of Canadians or 5% of Canadians who formerly were still either neutral or multi-culti or Islam sympathizers would say, screw this, I was wrong, let's get, you know, what we call 9/11 conservatives. There'd be another 4 or 5%, maybe 10% of Canadians would become 9/11 conservatives. And I think that's and that's why. I think that they made a deal. We'll get here. We know these guys are going to do this. We'll tell you who they are. We'll tell you what the operation is. But the condition is you must not associate it with Islam in any way because it slows down the project. And that's my if you listen, if I were to go play that press conference again, suddenly it perfectly fits, right? Because remember, like, basically nothing is crazy. Only there's something you don't know yet. There's a puzzle piece missing that makes it make sense, right? So when you listen to these guys, you go, well, you know they're not stupid. You know they're not, like, they must know, because you can't not know it's an Islamic thing and be that good at ducking your way around it. Like when they say, is this an environmental thing? No. Right? Like, you can't be that fast on the draw about something else if you don't. So clearly they know, right? And they're not stupid. So it's all about that missing puzzle piece. And that missing puzzle piece is, I think, that the Islamic community gave it up, just like David Wood said, that somebody in the community gave it up, and for that exact reason, to make sure that Islam doesn't take the heat. And I'm here to make sure that they do, because they were Muslim converts.
That's right. That's our job, isn't it? To expose them every step of the way.
Yeah, well, apparently, according to other news sites, and it's been hard to track this down, but according to other news sites, they were yelling Allahu Akbar, and they were doing... they were doing a whole bunch of other, like, Islamic stuff and, going on about jihad at the time. And so there you go. So, there was just – and they were – I don't care if they were converts or not. They were Muslims, right?
No.
They were religious
right.
Muslims. They went to the mosque. They believed all that stuff. It's the ideology that matters. And, there was a local radio program here. Go ahead, Jeff. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, but this does seem to be – as you say, the Al Qaeda's plan now to use small cells of people is what we saw with in Boston, two people there, with what happened to poor Lee Rigby, two there, and as you say, what happened in Canada, another two. It does seem to, as you said earlier, it does seem that they think that they can probably work better with small cells of people than, as you say, on a massive scale. I mean, 20 or 30 people. But this is what I think we've got to keep a close eye on, is because, all of a sudden they might change their tactics and do something totally different. So I think that's something that our secret services, they must keep a close eye on it. And thank God, the grace of God go the people that uncovered this, what was going on, because it could... how was they really near to actually setting this bomb off, these bombs off there, Vlad? How close was they?
Well, the bombs were in place at the legislature.
They was in place.
According to the OS, yes, and they were meant to go off July 1st, which is our national day, right? And but according to the police, the bombs were inert, so presumably one of the police had managed to get in and substitute an ingredient or provided one of the ingredients for the explosive that wasn't actually active. So they said at no point was the public in any real danger. But
because I wasn't sure. So they'd already, basically what they'd done, it seemed like they'd infiltrated it, or they knew exactly what was going on, and they just wanted to get them really in the act to explode these devices. But then they was, as I say, they was probably being under watch, because not being funny, our secret services are pretty good, aren't they? You know what I'm saying? So it's quite obvious.
Well, I mean, if they're watching everybody all the time with the most sophisticated software and computer equipment, like the prison, with the NSA, in the States, with their prison program, and then you've got the CSE in Canada, and then you've got, MI5 or MI6 in the UK, which it turns out, according to a news story today, is every bit as evil as America's NSA is. And the French, and here's the thing. That's another subject that really deserves scrutiny. Even if we win this thing, we lose. And actually a lot of Muslim groups know that, and they're all for it. Even if we win this thing with Islam, we still create the way we're approaching this war. The way we're approaching it, we're still creating a totalitarian state. So basically, we're being given a choice here. You can either become like under Islam totalitarian, no thank you, or under a fascist police state where in order to not profile one ideology over another, everybody's watched all the time. No thank you. I find them both to be equally repugnant and equally anti-freedom. Because once the police start watching everybody, you never know who's in power. It could be some – just to make up an example almost at random, what if the Americans were to elect like some leftist that decides all of a sudden to target the Internal Revenue Service to examine everybody's records, who happens to be conservative or join the Tea Party or be pro-Israel? Like, that would be a grotesque abuse of that system, wouldn't it? And that's why you can't have that. You can't. It would be better to suffer a couple of terrorist attacks, frankly, and then to turn on the right cause. It's like, how do I put this? If it was the Nazis, right? If it was the Nazis doing all these attacks, then You don't just say, well, we're going to watch everybody, and we're not going to put any special focus on Nazi community centers, and we're not going to pay attention to Nazi leaders. We'll let them say what they want under freedom of ideology or whatever have you. And basically, we're just going to watch everybody, and as long as we're anti-Nazi, it's okay, because we'll stop those guys from doing what they do. But that's an obscene way to do it. You're creating a Nazi state to prevent one. No, you have to look at the ideology that's the motive behind this, and you have to get rid of it. You fight it openly, and you get rid of it. Otherwise, when you have no mission, look what happened in Afghanistan. You have no clear mission statement.
Yeah, very good point there. You know, as I say, it's very worrying times. It's like a catch. What's the word? Catch 77. Oh, I can't remember. You know, if you go one way, you'll have problems. If you go the other way, you're going to have worse problems. So it's knowing exactly how the situation is going to be there. If you said sometimes there's a terrorist attack, because I do believe. Especially in the United Kingdom, I do believe that what we saw with Lee Rigby isn't the last of these attacks, and probably the same as yourself. You know, reality check is that there's going to be further attacks, you know, before something's really done positively in our countries. And it's horrible to actually say that, but these people are not just going to give up. You know that they're just going to keep pushing it and pushing it until people really, really had enough of what's been going on and want a total change of what's going on, you know, the way that the political arena is and everything. You know, things need to change. So, as I say, it is a very... very dangerous times we live in, isn't they, Vlad? I've said that before.
And it's dangerous. What makes it dangerous, I think, is the hidden dangers. I mean, there's the obvious dangers, but there's all these ones we're discovering about our own governments that are not only utterly failing to protect us, but actually they look like they're as much of the problem or more. As you know, there's just nobody left that's representing a free and democratic and classically liberal society. And of course, with multiculturalism, at the end of the day, how can you? Because how do you know who to represent when there's no cohesive group anymore? I mean, it's obscene. So, but just to switch gears just for a moment, last week there was a great deal of discussion about Melanie Phillips and her statement about the EDL and so on, which I think we're overblown to a degree, but they were still worthy of discussion. I think she got more flack for it than she deserved, because she, again, it should be pointed out that she was one of the people certainly before me, and before a lot of people started to take on this issue. She had courageously gone into the mainstream and said Islam is a catastrophic problem for England and Britain's values, and she'd written Londonistan. And she was on speaking tours, and she'd go on TV, and she wrote, you know what I mean? Like, she was one of the very first people using her own name to be out there in front of people talking about Islam and what a huge problem is, and how grotesque a legal system it is, and how anathema it is to Western liberalism. So if she said a couple of things that we don't like, and I don't like them either, I still got to say I'm not going to come down on her as hard. However, this week there's at least equally good news. In fact, it made me all giddy. You must have seen that Pat Condell video.
I've actually got it in the studio, and
hit
maybe
the button,
one
hit
will.
The button.
Yeah, I was going to say what I was going to do. There, Vlad, is we've got a caller that's just called in, and I was wondering, because he said he's going to call in, so I was wondering if we should take this caller for the moment.
Yes,
and then,
please. Yeah.
Okay, so James, you're live on East Anglia's EDL Radio. Go ahead, brother. Go ahead, James.
All right there?
Yeah, hi, James. Welcome to the show.
Oh, welcome. Thanks for letting me on here.
You're very welcome. Did you have a question for myself or Vlad?
I just wanted to say, what's the topic tonight we're talking about?
Well, we've got a few topics that we're talking about tonight. We've just been talking about things that's been going on in Canada. And we, you know, just basically the topics, you know, we're even going to start elaborating a little bit on what's going on with the you know, with the Muslim Brotherhood and Morsi being ousted,
yeah.
And that. So these are things that we will be discussing tonight. So was there anything specifically you'd like to ask, as I say, Vlad or myself there, James?
Just what do you think on the, you know, all the, as you're talking about the poor stuff, you know, that happened with poor Lee Rigby and that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, what we saw, and I think most of us will agree, what we saw on the streets of London, for quite a while, you know, with the EDL was said that one day, you know, the sort of thing that we saw, which was absolutely horrific.
Yeah.
It was near a school. It was so public, and it was horrific that we spoke about this some time. You know, over the years, we said that, you know, this would happen one day. Yeah, but yeah, that's the thing. This what we spoke about before, that this sort of thing would come about, and when it did, it shocked us all. It shocked everybody. I mean, it was probably the most horrific thing to see. And the thing that got me more than anything, it was the cowardice behind it. You know, actually drive the poor man down and then go about doing what they did was, and of course, then quoting after they'd done that, waiting for the police to arrive and standing around asking people to take pictures of them, quoting verses from the Quran, saying that we were commanded to do this by the Quran. Well, you know, I mean, that was it. It just everybody just went crazy about it, didn't they? So, and of course, it made people, you know, before people was a little bit sitting on the fence where the EDL was concerned. And when that horrific thing happened to poor Lee Rigby, it opened people's minds, eyes up to what we've been saying for all the, you know, the last 4 years. It's the truth. It's what we've been saying. This is what's going to happen due to the way the politics is in this country, weak leadership, and with the things that's going on due to, as I say, due to the politicians and that. So yeah, so that's something that needed to be put out there. But as I say, more people, you know, since then, we, you know, the website's gone crazy. You know, people just realise what we've been saying all along has been the truth. We don't lie. We don't lie about things. We don't try to misinform anybody. You know, it's not what we're all about. We're here to get the truth out. The truth, you know, will never be, you know, silenced. It's what politicians try to achieve, and political police, and it's not going to happen. Because it's people like myself, or people like Vlad, people like Tommy Robinson, Kevin Carroll, and lots of us, we will not allow them to suppress the truth that needs to get out there. Our listeners need to know what's going on, and that's what we try to do, to inform people. So, I don't know, Vlad, I think you agree with most of that.
Well, of course I agree with you, but I have a... If the question is, you know, what about this Lee Rigby, what's my reaction? I think we've had a bit of time and distance from it now, and I'm thinking that there was the second injury to the British people was the government and media colluding together to whitewash the incident and remove the motive from the attack. And I think, again, this is identical to what we saw in Canada 3 days ago, when we saw the press conference that we just played out, that RCMP press conference, that strange farcical anti-information, you know, where they did everything they could to make sure we had no idea to whitewash any connection with the actual ideology that motivated them, and I think that is something about which the public should be equally angry, both in the Lee Rigby case, and of course when an attack doesn't work, it doesn't get people very excited. So Canadians think that we don't have a problem because we've caught them all. Well, there's been, I don't know, a dozen or more attempts at terror attacks in Canada, but they've been stopped. Well, okay, but that doesn't mean there's no problem. It just means that They haven't got to the point where people notice them. But again, the fact that there's been this effort by government, now it's much worse in England than it is in Canada. In Canada,
yes.
We've seen media come out and connected. Like within about 10 hours of the attempted on July 1st, the attempted terror attack, we've seen media came out and said, yes, his lawyers confirmed they were converts to Islam. Yes, this is a jihadi attack. But the government and the police did exactly what they did in the UK. And where your media now remember that video that the killer of Lee Rigby made someone stop with a cell phone and recorded
yeah.
the whole thing. Okay. In my opinion, there were two ways which would have been reasonably acceptable to me how the government or media could have handled it. One is not showing the video at all. They could say, look, we don't feel this person has a right to use this horrific act of terror and criminal act to get his message out. And I would have kind of got that. You know what I mean? I would have kind of respected that. I wouldn't have liked it, but I would have respected it because there's a real and legitimate argument to be made that you shouldn't be able to commit a crime to get what you want. That includes making your agenda known to the public, right? So, especially when it's political like that. So I kind of get that. And on the other hand, the other thing to do would be to release it as it was. But what they did, what the UK government and the media did, which I thought was absolutely unforgivable, was they edited it so that you got to see, it made the killer look like a sympathetic character. What is the part you saw? He said, oh, well, I'm so sorry that women and children have to see this. Well, actually, they didn't have to see it. All that you had to do for them not to see it was not kill that guy. But what the government did and the media did is make him an absolutely sympathetic character. They made it look like, oh, what a nice guy. He was so concerned about how people might react that had to see this horrific thing. Well, no, he did it. And then
what we saw there, by the politicians, I say by the media, was like state TV, the way that the government wants it to be seen. That is exactly what we see. We saw that with the way that Sky done it, the BBC. Everybody done that, a sanitised version of what we
they all did it that
saw.
Same way, like, to make him look not that bad, even though he was the one that went down on that street and killed them poor Bernie's, like, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. It's not right. We don't go around killing all of them lot, do we?
No, we don't. Well, no, that's it. All it does is it makes our case what we've been saying right along about these people. You know, that they are in it. You know, I blame the problems we got are firmly on our politicians. It's that they've allowed this scenario. And when they try to demonise themselves within the EDL, we're a symptom of what they've created. If it wasn't for their incompetence and the way that they've been managing this country for year in, year out, we wouldn't be here probably, because we'd have politicians with the backbone to do what's right for our countries and our nations. I don't know if you agree with me there, but that is the case. I mean, you know, we're a symptom of what they've created. I mean, basically, we're the symptom, but also we're the cure as well. I've got to put that because, you know, what we're doing is we are pointing our fingers at these politicians to say, you better do something. You know, we're going to keep going in the streets. We're going to demonstrate where we get certain crimes going on. We're going to go to the places where the people want us to go, and that's what we continue to go, whether they like it or not. That's what we've done for the last 4 years. And, of course, you know, myself and Vlad, we don't call them they like to use the word grooming gangs over here, don't they? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I've heard that a lot. They always say that.
Yeah, but it is really Islamic slavery. This is what myself and Vlad, we've talked about this before, and I come to the same conclusion. We should use the term of what it really is, what we see before us. And you'd echo my view on that as well, wouldn't you, Vlad? Because you said that, and I'm with what you said, because that's so true. Because that's what we've got before, is Islamic slavery gangs.
What Muslim, organized Muslim slaving gangs are doing in the UK is just a minor variation of what they've been doing since the founding of that cult, a founding of that. Basically, it's kind of like a sort of land pirate thing. But I mean, right from the beginning, it was about stealing people for slaves. Male children, if they were the right age, as janissaries to end up becoming soldiers to fight other infidels, and the women as sex slaves. By the way, I don't know if anyone's aware of this or not. There's a movie that was recently, I mean, very recently released, and it's a big budget, really well done, properly acted, good editing and so on. I mean, a real big budget movie. I don't know where it's. I think it might have been made in Poland, but it's called 9/11/1683, I think, and it's actually about the attack at the gates of Vienna on September 11th, 1683, and how they were repulsed by the Polish king. And it's an incredible piece of history. Most people at this point know a little bit about it, but this goes into all the details about how Islam had signed a treaty with the Viennese, agreeing not to attack them because they'd lost the last war, and then just waited, you know, a year or two, and then saw they were weak and did it again, which is exactly what they did in Medina. And I'm bringing all this up because we in the West, we just have lost our sense of history. I'm not exactly sure why. I guess we've just been so successful and so affluent, and we have a surplus of food to the extent that people who live in cities don't really understand where it comes from, and we have a surplus of just general hedonistic pleasures that we just can't be bothered to remember what our roots are. But the Muslims have not forgotten. That's why that attack came in Manhattan in 9/11. And, you know, they see their history a little differently, but they remember it. And this movie, if anyone's got a chance, I don't know where you get it. I guess you could BitTorrent it or you could look for it online. I know there's trailers on YouTube. I don't know if the whole movie's out there. But someone sent me a copy, and, wow, it's really, really good. And if people want to get a good, clear idea, I mean, not just in terms of it's great because it shows the history, and it's great because it's an entertaining and well-made movie, but it's also great because it's so cathartic to see that the problem we have today is an old one, because this is made in a historically accurate manner. You're seeing all kinds of Muslims descending on European cities, shouting Allahu, Allah Akbar, and, you know, doing the raping and the killing, and all justified by Quran. And you're seeing, oh, okay, this is not a new thing. The only thing that was new was the brief period during colonization when Europeans went into the Middle East, stopped them from doing that, and imposed a little civility. And now that that period of history is over, we're right back to this. And yes, I won't call it grooming gangs. I call it, you know, there's no word in English for something as awful as what this is. But it's essentially, it's sexual slavery. It's forced prostitution of children. It's just like, it's kind of like, you know how in English there's a word for a person who's lost their parents is called an orphan, and somebody who's lost a wife is called a widower, and a wife who's lost a husband is called a widow. But in English, there's no word for a parent that's lost a child, because it's such a horrific idea that there's no single word for it, right?
No,
it's
just not.
And there's no word in English to describe this. You know, there's no word in English that could describe this. It's the same thing. No. Like, you know, I read the accounts of what these animals did to these young, vulnerable girls, and I don't care what their circumstances were. When you meet a young girl that's, you know, for whatever reason had a horrible background, horrible existence, what you have a greater obligation to help her, not to take advantage of the situation.
I agree. I definitely agree with you 100% there, Vlad. You know, as you say, there's not a word for people lost their children in that way. I agree. And it is to most of us as civilized people, what we've been seeing, it totally goes against all the things that we've been brought up to believe. It's totally taboo, isn't it? The word is taboo, but these people seem to relish the taboo. The things that we totally, I mean, necrophilia, my goodness sake, in Egypt a little while ago, they've tried to, I don't know if they might even brought it in, that, you know, if a wife passes away, that a husband's allowed to have sexual intercourse with her for 6 hours, or I think one of them even tried to extend it to 12 hours. So it show you the depravity of this cult. You know, it seems just to get worse, and they try to impose these other I don't know, it's just crazy. You just can't think that that people do it, but they do. That's what
I think that was
the
actually.
The more you dig into it,
the worse it smells. I think that was actually based on a hadith about Mohammed and his aunt, believe it or not. It's a more obscure hadith, but it's just, whatever it is they think, which actually brings me to a topic that's kind of close to my heart, and I think I'd like to take a moment to talk about it because it's another part of the issue of fighting this thing, right? And I know that what a lot of people do, and even some people I really admire and respect, do this one strategy, and sometimes I do it too, right? And I'm against it, so I'm letting you know I'm a hypocrite right out of the gates. I think we should never, ever discuss, I mean, when we're talking to supporters of Islam or Muslims or whatever, we should never take the position that Islam allows it or does not. In other words, quite often I'll see people saying, oh, well, you know, I don't know why these women wear headscarves. It's not in the Quran. It's not mandated by Islam. And the minute you say that, you've lost the debate. Why? Because when you're talking to people who represent an irrational, superstitious ideology, they can just make up what they want. They can interpret it the way they want. You can't possibly win. The only person that ever consistently wins that is Robert Spencer, right? I think maybe Andrew Boston.
He's brilliant.
Both those men are absolutely brilliant. I've had the privilege of speaking to both of them a number of times, and they're giants among men. But Robert Spencer, I think, is the exception because he actually can wade out there. And in fact, he's so good at it that in a recent BBC interview, an imam actually said,
"Yeah, I saw that." Go ahead, man. It was awesome.
It was priceless. I know. He said, "I won't discuss this because I'm not gonna argue with Robert Spencer about Quran because Quran is his field." And even the BBC host who'd set this guy up, hoping it would be a slaughter, the BBC host said, "But you're an imam. He's an imam of the
you're
East London
imam.
Mosque." it just goes to
show you, this is it. I don't know if James, if you've heard the Robert Spencer debate with anybody, but it is fascinating to watch him because the opposition normally start getting annoyed and rather abusive, don't they?
Yeah.
Well, that's all they can do.
You always
know,
right? That they lose in the argument because they start getting abusive and getting really personal. And I've heard Robert a few times snap back, you know. He's talked so much and he's had a bit of a dig back, but he's always normally top of his composure, isn't he, Vlad? He's so good.
Well, he is.
Debate.
I know he's extremely, like I say, he's a giant among men. But I just want to try to wade through my own hazy muck here to my point, and it's this: for the rest of us, right? I think it's really important that the only thing that matters is our laws, our culture, and our way of life. In other words, when there's a conflict between Islam and our thing, don't try to get clever and say, but Islam doesn't require this, because you'll lose. You'll lose by necessity, right? Including the headscarf thing. Yeah, it's true. It doesn't, in the Quran, all it says is women should hide what Allah has hidden. What the heck does that mean? Their spleen, their kidney? According to that, they should be naked. People are born naked. They should be able to be naked, right? But because all the Quran says is that, women must hide what Allah has hidden. Yeah, who the hell knows what that even means? The Quran, by the way, is one of the most boring and crappy and worst written books in human history. It staggers. It blows my mind.
And it's out of context as well, isn't it? It's out of chronological order.
It's even out of order. It's not. It's out of chronological order. It's actually put in the order of, I think, shortest chapter to longest, or longest to shortest, which has to be the stupidest way to order a book in all of human history. I mean, it's like watching one of those movies where it's constant series of flashbacks, so that, you know, you, at some point you completely lost as to what's going on, except that it's not even organized so that you do know. I mean, it's a horrifically tedious book.
No wonder so many Muslims have, Vlad, sorry to interject, I was going to say, so it's no wonder the Muslims go to these imams, because they look at it and they just don't understand it. And, of course, because, as you say, it's out of chronological order, it's very boring, and things doesn't seem right. When you read something in there, and you read a bit further, it's changed, and it changes back to before the other story. You know, it's totally, it's very confusing. I don't know how people managed to get through it. And
I've tried reading them, and it's back and forth, repeating each sentence every time.
Well, James, there's a couple of books that I want. Robert Spencer's Infidel's Guide to the Quran is superb. I actually have it as an audio book. It's really good. It's, if anyone wants to understand this. Another one is a very obscure book, but I really like it. It's called Pain, Pleasure, and Prejudice by an Ottawa, Canada author by the name of Bernard Payeur. It's a French last name. That's P-A-Y-E-U-R, Papa, Alpha, Yankee, Echo, Uniform, Romeo. And Pain, Pleasure, and Prejudice, Bernard Payeur, you can get it online. And it's gone through a number of revisions. I'd like to give you the background on this book. The fellow who wrote it was a civil service in Canada, right? And he was a systems analyst, right? So very methodical. His job is to look at a chaotic thing and try to make sense of it so that it's efficient, right? That was his job. It's an interesting and a very, you know, high intellectual capacity job, you know? Anyway, he was, like most people in our countries, very politically correct, and, you know, he thought any objection to any other culture was racist. So he decided that he was going to write a book about the Quran where he makes sense of it in order to dispel the kind of prejudices he saw going on around him, right? Only to discover that, in fact, they were right, and it was much worse than people had been saying. So he took the Quran and he put it in the chronological order so that you can actually read, you know, and then he explains abrogation. But then he also makes a whole bunch of interesting points that you won't see in other books, like just stuff that he noticed. One example that really sticks out in my head is he said there's no women named by name in the Quran except for Mary, and that's to say that she's not the mother of God. Let me explain more clearly what the point of this is. There is not, like, it doesn't name Eve. It doesn't name any woman, like, in the Quran. There's no woman in the Quran that's actually named, except there's just some woman attached to a man, right? The only one woman that does specifically have a name is Mary, and the reason they name Mary is to devalue her, to make sure that any reader of the Quran knows that she's just some other chick. And that Jesus is just now, I'm not trying to say that she is the mother of God, and I'm not trying to say that Jesus is God. That's not my point. My point is that the only woman actually named in the Quran has done so to lower her status, and I think that that's noteworthy. And that's one of the points in his book, Pain, Pleasure, and Prejudice. But so back to this thing. When we're looking at how to deal with discussing Islam with people, I think it's really important that we just say, I don't care what Islam says, rather than, well, it doesn't say this in the Quran. I think it's important that we remember who we are and say, no, our laws say we have freedom. You know, when people talk, like, there's a huge, huge push on by major powerful people. Like, I don't just mean the United Nations. I mean the President of the United States, the Secretary of State Clinton. There's a major push on to destroy freedom of speech worldwide, to create a new version of medieval blasphemy laws, and only to be applied to Islam, right? So that thing I said about Islam, that the Quran is like maybe the shittiest book ever written, like that's just a book review, right? If I said it about any other book, there's not going to be a problem. If the right person hears me say that and knows who I am, I'm going to pay it could be a legal price. I could go to jail because it's, I don't know, racism or defamation of religion or some stupid crap like that. Or I could, you know, somebody who feels more strongly could do me personal harm because he thinks I have no right to say that because the book's above criticism. Well, whether it is above criticism or it's not above criticism, let me state for the record, the Quran is probably the most tedious, crappiest, pointless book ever written. And it's done unspeakable amount of damage. But so having said that, we
Crimes Against Humanity comes into I think of it, Crimes Against Humanity, how many people have died over, you know, 288 million at least, or 278 million people died in the name of Islam, and that's only the known one. So there's probably a lot more. And so that I will say that's a crime against humanity over the time that Islam's been around, basically.
Yes, yeah,
maybe a bit
that,
more.
Yeah, that's all what a book, just one book, can cause all that trouble. Like, Did you say 288,000?
Well, yeah, I might be slightly wrong because, you know, Vlad might. I've got to say, ladies and gentlemen, once again, we've got a great guy who's a co-host tonight. He's Vlad Tepes. He's got Vlad Tepes blog. Is it blog.com? Is it Vlad?
Yes, it is. Vlad Tepes blog. VladTepesBlog.com. Please visit. I've been under steady DDoS attack for some time. It's cost me at least half my regular viewers. So you know my view stats have dropped by half. And you know if people want to fight back against that, they can just come and visit my site. Doesn't cost anything.
Yeah,
just come. Come and check the news out, check the links out, see what's what. You know. But so again, we have to say, you know, when they talk about halal in schools and whether Muslims require halal food or not, you know, our answer should not be, well, where does it say in the Quran or by what Islamic rule do you have to eat this food, right? Our answer should be, no, we have our own laws about the way food is handled. If you don't like them, then, you know, go eat somewhere else. Like, we have to remember that we have our own culture, our own. Let's talk about the halal meat thing, for example, right? I don't know about England, but Canada has excellent animal cruelty laws. They're maybe even not quite good enough, but they're going in the right direction, where animals have to be handled a certain way. Farm animals have to be treated in a humane fashion, and they have to be slaughtered as humanely as possible, right? And I'm an avid meat eater. I believe that if you love cows, you should eat them, because if you don't eat them, they're going to go extinct, because the only reason there are any cows is farmers raise them for you to eat. So like potatoes, if you like them, you should eat them. But at the same time, I feel they should be humanely treated. They should be humanely slaughtered. And that is the general consensus of the public of Canada, and I'm sure in the UK. Now, halal, if you've gone on and watched any videos of halal slaughter, it is horrific. It is deliberate.
I've only watched
it
a couple of times.
It's so awful. It's like Islam itself. It seems to be designed to create fear and horror and pain and suffering in the animal, just like Islam itself. I mean, sometimes I think that the people Muhammad hated the most were his own followers, but that's a subject for another show. So we should be saying, no, we as a democratic society, and we sort of are one, we have animal cruelty laws, and halal violates them. So you don't get to do that. I don't care what the Quran says. I don't care what they do say. I don't care what Islamic organizations say. If you want to eat like that and you want to handle your livestock like that, do it somewhere else. But we are under no obligation to allow you to do it. We have our own laws. Why are we making exceptions for group? If you make an exception for a group just because they want to do it, then what's the point of having the law at all? And let me go one tiny step further. What's even more preposterous? Can I just make up an imaginary scenario? Let's say that you had some British people that had a very, very rare disease, and the only cure for that disease was that they had to eat meat that was slaughtered in that way, right? And you had medical scientific proof that this was the case. Okay, then I would say slaughter the minimum number of cattle for those people to get their cure or their treatment, right, for this disease. But the idea that, because then I could see why you'd make an exception, because science demands it in the interest of curing people who are suffering from a disease up until we find a cure that doesn't require that. That's the history of modern medicine. But what we're doing is making exceptions to important laws, not because something really requires it, but because some arbitrary, barbaric, superstitious and alien belief system asks for it. And we are giving more importance to the fact that people believe a bunch of crap than we are to our own culture, our own science, what we know is true, what matters to us. If we're going to adjust our laws and rules for arbitrary, superstitious or belief systems, let them be ours.
Yes. I would agree 100% what you said there, and well said about that. I was going to say, Vlad, as we've been chatting away for quite a while, I was wondering, should we play this pack on day? So I've had so many people talking about it today.
It is. I have to say, it made my whole week. Made my whole week. Please put that. Yeah, play that clip.
I most certainly will. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, this is absolutely fantastic. Everybody's talking about this pack on Delclerc. Very much endorses the EDL with it. So here we go, guys. Vlad, I'll be back in a minute. I've just got to call back in, okay? So just play it. And
super. Okay.
Here we go.
Yeah. Okay, this is a video about liars, cowards, fascists, and hate mongers. I hope you enjoy it. People keep asking me what I think about the English Defence League, so I went to their website and read it quite carefully, looking for racism and fascism, of course, because the media keep telling me that they're far right, but, well, I'm a little puzzled because all I can find is a healthy regard for human rights, democracy, and the rule of law, not a whiff of racism or fascism, and not a hint of far right politics of any kind. Am I missing something? Now, I realize what a minefield I'm stepping into here, because I've noticed that anyone who doesn't condemn the EDL as far-right, fascist, and racist is instantly written off as far-right, fascist, and racist. But if I cared about my personal reputation, I would have stopped making videos a long time ago. I don't care what anyone thinks of me. I care what I think of me, and I care about the truth. And from my observations, the truth is that the EDL are not the problem. They're merely a symptom of a wider problem that nobody wants to address because we're all afraid of the truth. There's a word for that, veritophobia. So you see, we do have a phobia after all. When did we all become so afraid of the truth? When we realized that the truth offends Islam, and that when Islam is offended, violence is never far away. This is why we've trimmed our rights and freedoms so that we can no longer even speak our mind without fear of being arrested. We've twisted ourselves like pretzels to accommodate an aggressive, supremacist religion that despises everything we stand for. Not that we stand for much anymore, because all our values have been turned inside out. What's right is wrong, what's wrong is correct, what's correct is right. We don't know if we're coming or going anymore, and that is a symptom of a condition, the condition of people who don't really believe in anything because they have no reason to, and who have never had to defend anything of value in their lives. Who wouldn't know how? Now, nobody's suggesting that the EDL doesn't have its share of bad apples, but I can't help thinking that if it was a movement of middle-class university students, the media would portray it in a completely different way. But because it's mainly working-class men, they desperately want them to be fascist and racist, because if working-class men have a political opinion, it has to be a violent, subhuman opinion, because that's who they are. They're all football hooligans at heart. Never mind that their demonstrations are always peaceful because they may be working class, but they're not stupid, and they know what would happen to them if they weren't peaceful. And how else are they supposed to get their voices heard? Write a column in The Guardian, perhaps. Peaceful street protest is all they've got. Whenever violence does occur, it's always instigated by a mob of middle-class left-wing thugs, ironically called Unite Against Fascism, who turn up with the express intention of using violence to stamp on free speech. And this is because Unite Against Fascism, despite its virtuous sounding name, is actually a front for the hardline Socialist Workers' Party, which is full of angry middle-class casualties who still hate their parents, who wouldn't know a day's work if it bit them on the arse, and who patronize the working class because they hate and fear them. When these self-righteous cretins are not violently defending Islamic jihad, they're busy shouting down people who advocate democracy and the supremacy of parliament, who they also regard as fascists. But these are the real fascists, and these are the people the police should be focusing on, the extreme nutcase fringe of the hard-left, nutcase fringe, Stalinist wing. They persuaded a bunch of politicians and other public figures to sign their mission statement by lying and calling themselves anti-fascists, thus neatly acquiring for themselves license to practice the politics of the jackboot, to operate outside the law and to explicitly endorse and use violence to silence opinions they disapprove of. If any other political organization behaved like this, it would be shut down. But the police, the politicians, and the middle-class media are all so terrified of the truth, they'd rather focus obsessively on a symptom of the problem and give the real fascists a free ride. Recently, when one of their leadership was accused of rape, the Socialist Workers' Party handled the situation with all the crass misogyny you would expect from their friends in the Sharia court. They didn't report the allegations to the police because, as they put it, they had no faith in the bourgeois court system to deliver justice. Still sound like your kind of people, middle-class lefties? Instead, the women, yes, there were more than one, were aggressively cross-examined about their social history and sexual conduct, and then the matter was whitewashed internally. One of them actually said that, in her opinion, the Socialist Workers' Party is a dangerous environment for women. These are the people behind Unite Against Fascism, just so you know who you're actually supporting from your cozy, progressive, middle-class bubble. Another jihad-supporting far-left hate group with a misleading name is Hope Not Hate, and recently, along with British MP Keith Vaz, a man for whom the word oleaginous might have been personally coined, they were instrumental in persuading the government to ban two prominent American critics of Islam from visiting Britain. It didn't matter that what they say about Islam is true. Indeed, this is precisely why they were banned, because it is true and provably so. Robert Spencer is an Islamic scholar. He knows the Quran better than most Muslims, including imams, as he proved recently in a radio interview when an imam incredibly accused him of having the advantage because Islam is his specialist subject. He and Pamela Geller have been banned from Britain because they tell the truth, and because the truth is a threat to Islam. Therefore, the truth, according to the UK government, is not conducive to the public good, which is a cowardly way of saying Muslims might become violent. In short, because Islam is afraid of the truth, we all have to be afraid of it. Afraid to speak it, afraid even to listen to it. Thanks to Islam, the truth has become our enemy, and future generations will pay a very heavy price with their freedom for that, because when the truth is your enemy, you know, and the world knows, that you are going to lose. It's just a matter of when.
Well, there you go. What do you say about that?
I'd like to add one tiny thing to the end of that. When he said, when truth is your enemy, you know you're going to lose, it's just a matter of when, I'd like to offer a formula for that.
Yeah.
The more deviant you are from the truth, the sooner you're going to lose, right? So let's say you went to a restaurant and they told you, you ordered the beef, but it was actually lamb, and you ordered the lamb and it was actually pork. Okay, well, these are fairly minor deviations from the truth. You could probably live most of your life, and you're not going to lose based on those abuses of truth. But if you went in and you ordered the steak and they gave you potassium cyanide, you're going to die right away. So the more you deviate from the truth, the faster you're going to lose. It's that simple. And these are, and as Mr. Condell says, we are deviating from the truth and making it illegal to even hear it at a very, very rapid rate. Anyway, it did my heart good to hear that, to hear his outright and endorsement and explanation for the EDL. That took a lot of courage. It took a lot of courage, and I'm really hoping that that means the tides are turning and that, you know, maybe there'll be a few hundred thousand more signups. There needs to be more political pressure on the government of the UK to start behaving in a rational fashion when it comes to immigration and defending its own values and defending its own people. It's a historically unprecedented thing to see genocide by population replacement by your own government. I'm just not aware of it. It's just so huge and horrifying that I think still most of you don't even get it. Jeff, do you happen to see anybody on the phone?
Yeah, just one moment. I was just starting to chat to someone. Yeah, well, I've got someone at 514.
Yes, that would be
cool.
It. I think we may have somebody calling in to talk about a bunch of subjects, and I'm really looking forward to hearing what she has to say. Why don't we bring her on? Let her introduce herself.
Okay, then. I'm not sure the lady's name, Vlad, but welcome to the East Anglia's EDL radio show. You're very welcome. Go ahead.
Hi there. Am I on?
Yes,
you certainly are.
Oh, okay. Hi. I'm calling from Montreal. It's my name is Cynthia Sweeney.
And
I just... Hi, thank
Cynthia.
You.
Cynthia writes... for a number of publications. Many of us have probably read her articles in different places, different times, and different names, but I've read a few, and she's a brilliant researcher and writer. And you had some stuff to say about Quran.
Well, there was something I was thinking about. I was listening to you speak about the Quran and the reasons as to why it might have possibly been written the way it was, in other words, not in a chronological order. And I was thinking that possibly the reason why it was not written in chronological order is so that they didn't want you to see that the chapters were getting more and more progressively violent. This way, the readers convert to Islam. They would get more converts that way. Because if one were to read the Quran and see how violent it became as it went from Medina, they would have probably lost many converts. This way, it's very confused, and the reader doesn't really know what he's reading, and it would be a much easier way to get more converts. After all, that's what Islam is all about. It's to convert as many people as possible, as well as to establish the global caliphate. So that could be a possible reason why they did it that way. It was done on purpose.
It's certainly possible. I would be reluctant to speculate. I don't know. It's like I read a history of the Quran which suggested that Muhammad, because he was an illiterate, would just recite stuff to scribes. And then after he died, there was danger of the religion ending. I shouldn't call it danger, but that's the way they looked at it. So the first caliph, what was his name? It was a buddy of Muhammad's. He called all these scribes together and had them write down their parts, and he ordered it sort of arbitrarily from shortest chapter to longest or longest chapter to shortest, but he just put them together that way because
right, except for the first chapter. That's the shortest one.
Right, okay. So basically, like the history I read suggested that it was more or less arbitrary because the people felt they needed a book to unite this movement of pirates wandering the desert and attacking people and forcing their faith on them and taking their stuff. Whichever way they did decide to do it, it really, really is a difficult read.
Difficult. It's a very difficult read. And when readers read it, they don't really know what they're reading. And also, as we all know, we're not supposed to question the religion. We're not supposed to have any discussion about it. We're not supposed to dispute it. And it keeps the reader in a state of confusion, which is exactly what they want, and it's so much easier to get converts that way because they don't really know what's going on. They don't realize how violent this book is because it's all mixed up together in bits and pieces, so nothing really stands out.
Well, I wonder if that might explain why many of the very religious have those big brown bruises in the middle of their forehead. It's from smacking their head against the floor trying to figure out what this book actually says. But
maybe they're just so frustrated. But it is very frustrating. It is a frustrating book to read. But there are, you also mentioned, there are other books you can purchase where the order is actually in chronological order.
And it actually makes it pleasurable. Pain, Pleasure, and Prejudice is really fun to read. Again, especially because the angle that this fellow came at it with, he came at it from the point of view of trying to dispel people's animus towards Islam, and it turned out that he ended up developing enough of it that it became his whole life. It's like trying to – he's written several books now and all kinds of pamphlets about the teachings of this religion, and he's not that well known. He doesn't promote himself much, but he's quite an interesting fellow. And of course, Robert Spencer's book, I think it's Quran for Infidels, or Infidels Guide to Understanding the Quran, is a great book. And you can get it as an audio book as well as and it's great bedtime listening, you know. Anyway, Cynthia, what have you been following the news in Egypt?
Not today, unfortunately, not today. But it's just more of the same. Oh, more of the same. But
yeah,
actually, one more thing I did want to mention about the Quran. One second. My dog just ate my lunch here. I left my lunch on the table and she just grabbed it. Sorry about that.
That's what.
It must be a lab.
It is. I think that if you were to speak to some converts, I'm sure, in fact, I'm positive they don't know most of what's written in the Quran. If they were to read it in a chronological order, they would get a much better understanding of it, and possibly they would even choose not to convert.
This way,
they pick out the best verses, they pick out the best chapters, the ones that are not violent, and it seems more conducive to the reader, and then he'll decide, okay, I will convert. But if the reader, like I said, if he were to know how violent the chapters get progressively violent they get, I don't think half these converts would be converting to Islam. I really don't. I think it was done on purpose that way,
not to have it in chronological order.
Well,
my suspicion is that many of the people who convert to Islam in Western nations do it because they think it makes them morally superior and anti-racist. Like, they convert just because they want to show other people, you know, that it's not a bad religion. And you know what I mean? They want to make them.
And also because they're lost. They're lost.
Well, could be.
Because our culture is just getting all convoluted as well. Our own cultures are becoming convoluted and lost. People feel lost. They need something.
Yes, I agree with that. And that statement alone, you know, needs its own 2 hours. But I read a statistic that 75% of converts to Islam in Western nations actually just stop within a year. And the Muslims don't talk about that much, but the vast majority.
And then they can't convert back, as we all know.
Well, they do, though.
They can't convert back. I mean, it's so easy to convert to Islam, but it's impossible to get back to what you want to be. You can't do that.
Well, in our country, in terms of the realpolitik of it, you can, in the sense that if you convert to Islam and they go, I guess it's stupid, just stop. For now. But as Islam gains more and more primacy, you're absolutely right.
Right.
It won't be long before you don't have that choice. Like that poor guy in Australia that converted to Islam and then had a beer and then got lashed 40 times by his new Islamic friends. You're right. So as Islam is, and that's the thing that people don't understand about Sharia law that makes it so different from our system. Our system of law actually we abdicate our own right to the use of force in our own interest to a system which has to act impartially and fairly and has a monopoly on the use of force, and that would be the police, right? So that's the system that we have, and as long as the police continue to act in an impartial and fair manner and to enforce our laws as we see them as just and reasonable, then it's amazing how many of us go with that, and we even take the odd little hit now and again, if we feel we're being treated unfairly. We recognize that the system is still better, and we go with it. I mean, we developed an amazing thing here. But in Islam and Sharia law, every single Muslim is able to use deadly force as long as it's in the interest of advancing Islam. You can, you know, if somebody was to apostatize from Islam, Sharia law gives any Muslim the right to kill that person. So while they might get arrested in our system for doing so, within Islam, it's a perfectly legitimate and laudable thing to do. So
that's right. That's absolutely right.
We really need to make sure that, you know, we keep a grip on this and not let it spread, not let it grow. Because as this religion metastasizes due to the ignorance of the people in our societies that simply are refusing to look at what it is and trying to silence those of us that are exposing it. I mean, the irony, of course, is Anjem Chowdhury, not as much as some think. He does use a certain amount of art when he talks. But he does expose a great deal of what Islam really is. He does say he's quite open about a lot of it. Like,
oh, he absolutely is.
He really is, and it's because he's Muslim. I guess they can't call him a racist. But for the, you know, so people should really listen, because that's what's coming. You're seeing it. The Lee Rigby thing was not an exception. It's the new rule. It's just not enforced. It's not enforced yet much. And Jeff, this is what you were saying earlier. This is very much what you were saying, that EDL has been predicting that this is coming. But I'm fleshing it out. I'm just saying this is why it's coming, because Islam itself is a fundamentally different system than ours. We take maybe this isn't quite as true in England as it is here, but I tend to think of culture as being like an accent. A person doesn't really hear their own accent. Most people, when they speak, just think of themselves as being without one, and it's everybody else that has an accent, right? And I think culture is very much the same. So when you have people in our culture, they take it for granted that everybody has a police force, that everybody has a system of courts that's fair and rational, that that if you're in a dispute, that police will act impartially, and that if you feel that they weren't or that you've been unjustly accused, that before you're punished, you'll get to go in front of some kind of a decider, a judge of some kind, will get to, you know, who will listen to a reasonable argument and make a determination as both the innocence, guilt, or even, you know, what the punishment should be, should you be guilty, right? And I think that that's because that's the background noise of our culture, thanks to, you know, hundreds of years in the United States of constitutional law. And I don't know, Magna Carta is over 1,000 years old, right? Which does contain specific, I mean, it's been redone many, many, many times, but it definitely always has instances of why this is the case, right? So, but Islam is so not like that. And it's pretty important that people understand that Muslims feel they have an individual right. The ones who actually have this Islamic culture, that believe this stuff, that really are part of it. They believe they have, once they hit their numbers, hit a certain amount in a given society, that they can start any individual, they're all police, and they all have a right to force without trial, without argument.
Right, they can build their own system.
Up to including deadly force. Up including
their own way of life, and there are no-go zones.
Yes.
Until it's
exactly.
More.
Yeah.
And they are trying to say, as you know, in this country, there are certain parts of the country, especially like they tried it a while ago in Tower Hamlets, where they tried to create a Sharia zone, and people were being abused going through there, or going, oh, you're going past, you're not allowed to go past the mosque. You know, and that people having, you know, a young guy going along, have his beer taken off him. Young ladies are being abused by him, saying, you know, well, you shouldn't be around here, being verbally abused. And that is what we're seeing quite openly now. Okay, the police did get hold of it, and there was a few people that actually got arrested for actually grievous bodily harm as well. I didn't know exactly what happened, but a couple of them was done for it, but... It's just that they are so brazen, aren't they, with the way they go about it, quite openly, what they're trying to achieve and what they expect going to happen. Of course, we got these dimmy politicians who sort of, there's no problems in Islam. You know what, guys, I'd like to take them and say, right, you should stay here for, say, about 3 months, and just to see if you want the same idea about Islam, is the same after that time, to a politician, to get the feel of what most people who live within these communities, and what they see, people like Tommy Robinson, Kevin Carroll, people like Tommy English, who lives around, you know, that sort of situation. That's what I would say to politicians, all right, them saying this and that, but they do not have to live in the communities where these things are happening, where there's Islamic slavery going on right up and down the country, you know?
Them just don't care. They don't care, or they just figure that the next generation will take care of these problems, and they just don't want to deal with it. They live far away from these problems for now, and they just don't want to deal with it.
Exactly.
They're leaving it up to the next generation.
And
they
it's not
care.
Fair, you know, is it? Yeah, I don't know if you agree with me, Sip. It's just not fair. I mean, that's one of the reasons that I'm here, like yourself and Vlad and people like, Tommy Robinson, Kevin Carroll, and most of us are here, because it's not us. It is affecting us, but it's going to affect the future generations. It's our grandchildren. I'm thinking about my great-grandchildren. What's it going to be like there with the freedoms of being slowly and surely being crushed, freedom of speech, freedom of expression? I dread to think that what my great-grandchildren will have to go through, and probably same as yourself, Cynthia and Vlad, you know, the same thing.
Americans, it's the same thing in the United States. I was listening when you had mentioned what's going on in Egypt, and CNN, they were basically saying that, well, since Morsi was elected democratically, then he should stay. This is basically what CNN was trying to say throughout the week. He should stay. He was elected democratically, period, end of story. But he's not implementing any democratic principles. He doesn't stand for democracy. besides the fact that it was only, what was it, only about 45% of eligible Egyptians who participated in the elections, only 45% voted. And out of that 45%, Morsi won by how much, by 1.2% or something?
Yeah.
But that's irrelevant. The fact is that he has no plans. He has no plans to install any democratic principles. He wants to install Islam, and that's it.
That's all I see.
The good point. I mean, I look at it this way. In the end, it's the people. They say, no, we don't want the Muslim Brotherhood ruling their country. We don't like it. And it's quite obvious that was the case, and they realised that this isn't going down very well. And that's the reason why the people stood their ground. It's people. People power won over. You know, ousted
right.
The Muslim Brotherhood. And poor old Obama, he's probably he's stamping his feet, pulling his hair out. Same as David Cameron. It's not quite going to plan for them, is it? Would you not agree,
Well, yeah, I find that here in America, the people, they either don't know or they just don't care. They're not being fed the right information. And when they do have the information, they just don't bother to read it. But there will come a time when they have no choice but to see and look around them, see what's going on,
and
read
by
it.
That time, things could get very, very messy. So, Jeff, what's the chance that people from people in the EDL could, like, go secretly film in some no-go zones? I mean, I think one of the most important things that you can do that all across Europe, not just for Europe but for North America that hasn't maybe got it quite as bad yet, we have to go into no-go zones and we have to film what sort of stuff goes on and make people aware, because, you know, that's why they're winning.
Well, actually, you know, you say that, Vlad, but actually there was one of our lads actually filming it. This was outside Westminster Abbey, and there was just a load of these Muslims who was sort of worshipping right outside,
right.
And there was probably about 50 of them. And so one of our guys did take
this. They want Westminster Abbey. Eventually they plan on taking it.
Yeah.
At least that's one of their desires.
Yeah. And this is what I'm saying, there are people, you know, who are actually, you know, probably, as we talk now, there's probably saying, we're going to do that, you know, because it's quite obvious when, you know, when we're doing the radio show, lots of people listening thinking, right, that's a good idea, you know. So so it's something we'll probably be doing, you know, a bit of secret film here. So a good
but
point
there,
Vlad. But
there has been a film done. Sorry to interrupt you, sorry. But there was actually a four-part series done. It was done undercover in England.
Yes.
The Hidden Mosque series, you mean?
In a no-go zone. It was done a year, 2 years ago. And
what was
I think
it called?
It's online.
I would be interested in seeing it. But I think that more regular folk have to do this. Like, I think it has to be a grassroots thing more than, like, if you see something that's slick and well done and it just looks too much like a feature of the week, I mean, people need to just, like, one of the things, most effective videos that I've ever seen about this from the UK is about this one guy that was doing a history of a pencil factory or something like that, and two girls who lived in the area said, you know, hey, excuse me, you better get out of here, sir, this is a very dangerous place. He said, oh, really, why? I said, well, it's a Muslim area. See that guy who's circling the block? He's passed you three times. Well, he was talking into a microphone and looking into a camera and describing the history of this particular enterprise. It was the oldest one of its kind in England, and he was just doing some kind of a puff piece for a business thing. And the next thing you know, he was like, there's a huge crowd throwing stones at him. That got like hundreds of thousands of views. That's the kind of thing I think that people need to do, is just expose the methods that are being used to intimidate, ethnically cleanse British people and all non-Muslims out of their own homes and areas in this incremental takeover. It's just, you know, you're going to have to forget about your government coming in and actually representing you. That clearly isn't going to happen. But if enough people can start to realize, you know, you're just going to have, you know what I mean? Before you have to go all Egypt, maybe the thing to do is just to provide the information to the rest of the public. I don't know.
And then when people say, when they begin to say that this is only the minority that's doing it, the small minority, you have to remind them what happened in World War II. It was also the minority that took over. And look what happened.
Yeah,
it only takes the minority to take over the country, the world.
So, Jeff, what do you say? Have you got a song picked for maybe a 5-minute break?
Yes, I certainly have. Okay, and just one moment. Let's find. I did have something, and do you know what happens? I was looking for the PatCon Del tape, and I went right past the one that I was going to play. you put me on the hop there a minute there.
I am so sorry. I should really
okay. Watch guys, Cynthia, thank you so much for being a guest this evening as well. It's always great to have a great guest on the show, isn't it, Vlad? I'm trying to see. Oh my goodness me. Yeah. There you go. This is England. Okay. Just one moment. No, just a moment. Let me see. I'll come down a little bit there. Just bear with me. Sorry about it, ladies and gentlemen. Where is it now? It's one I was especially looking for. oh, dear. So I've got so many on here.
Play
tell
some
you what
Cat Stevens.
Doing.
I'm sure you'd appreciate that.
I don't think
we
like
Cat
Stevens. Peace Train. No, Jihad Train by Pete Stevens. That'd be great.
Yes, Jihad Train.
Now, what I've got is Won't Back Down, Tom Petty. There you go, guys. So, right, here we go. I think I've got it now. Supposed to do that, Mop. that does that every time, and I keep trying to stop that just before it does that. But anyway, welcome back, Cynthia, and of course, Vlad. So yeah, I'm sorry. I should have gotten that. I had the tune ready, and I've got so many things on in the studio now. I'll get very confused. You know, Vlad's busy. But once again, it's great to have you on this evening, Cynthia. Thank you.
Thank you. It's great to be on.
Cynthia, you wrote an article about Morocco a while ago. Do you remember that article?
Oh, yeah. I wrote a couple of articles about Morocco. I was just basically saying that Morocco is heading down that road as well. Just give it a little bit more time. I mean, Africa.
Go ahead.
Is on the way to becoming redominated by Islam, because at one time it was all under Islam, Northern Africa. So I wouldn't be surprised if things were to get hot in Morocco as well.
So if I recall, it was about either new blasphemy laws being implemented or possibly death for apostasy laws being implemented in Morocco.
That's right. They're talking about death to apostates. They were discussing it, and apparently it is a fatwa, but as they say about fatwas, nothing is written in stone, so to speak. But that's what they said, that apostates are given the death penalty. But we have yet to see if they're going to implement it. We haven't seen anything yet, but like I said, only time will tell, and I don't think things will be getting better there. That's just my view.
See, I think it's worth remembering that in the 1960s, both Afghanistan and Morocco were places that all the hippies and the Rolling Stones would all go for vacations, and they'd get high and, you know, have adventures of pure hedonism, right? So it's worth pointing out that these two places that were not that long ago, it really isn't that long ago by historical standards, it's just a wink of an eye. Used to be very easygoing places where Europeans and many, many British people went just to have a really good time with no fear. I mean, less fear of being harassed by the authorities than they would have been at home in England, right? This is really important. Mm-hmm. It's really important to realize that the turnaround is now in Afghanistan. Well, you just wouldn't be there unless you're in uniform and hopefully in a heavily fortified Humvee. And in Morocco is now got fatwas where they're talking about actually putting people to death who convert away from Islam. And please go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say that it's also because many people there are supporting more and more the radical Islamist opponents of the government right now, of the ruling Islamist party. Now, they're very mild, but the people, they want the more radical Islamist opponents to come in. And that's why I think that eventually they will get in.
Why do you
think
that is?
It's the power of the people.
Why suddenly, though, is there a push on by the people
in a country
like Morocco?
Because they feel empowered. The people, because there are Islamists there, or religious Muslims in Morocco, I should say, and they're pushing more forward because they feel empowered given what's going on in the world, given what's going on in Europe, in Northern Africa, you name it, in every part of the world, in the Philippines, and even in Indonesia. Papua.
I might
be pronouncing that country wrong, but even there, what's going on, they feel empowered because of what's going on globally. Muslims are being given more and more power to do what they want.
And certainly there's a close connection between the Muslim Brotherhood and all these events, right? It's a lot of it's being coordinated by the Muslim Brotherhood, which makes me wonder, this having them out of power in Egypt, is that going to make it easier for them to have resources to channel their efforts into other countries, or is this actually a partial victory for us? I mean, I know that it should be, and it seems obvious, hey, we got them out of power in Egypt, that's got to be a good thing, right? Except that if there's anything I've learned
from
the last
few years... Well, so far, we don't really know for sure what's going on in Egypt yet. Sometimes we might be speaking too soon. We don't know yet.
Right.
I would like to see them out of power, but I can't say with complete certainty that they are out of power. Not yet.
But if they were, do you think that would actually... Yeah.
I still think that they still do feel empowered. All these groups are tied in. All the radical religious Muslim groups, they all stick together. They're all connected somehow. In some way or form, they're connected. They work together. And they feed off one another. So if there's a setback in one area, it might just pop up in another area.
Well, we've seen, you know, we've
unless
seen...
we do something about it, that's the whole thing. We have to do something about it. It doesn't have to go this way. The people of Egypt, they stood up and they fought. And hopefully, hopefully we'll be happy with the results. But I can't thank America for that because they didn't have any input into what's going on in Egypt right now with the overthrow of Morsi.
They did, but on the other side. Like the Americans had actually trained. Yeah, they actually had sent in tons of a whole bunch of American troops, specially trained in riot control to defend the Morsi government. So you're right. We certainly cannot thank the Americans, but the American foreign policy is not. It's complete. It's at a right angle to anything it's ever been before. It's difficult to even talk about it at this stage, because even if I was right about what I think about it, I'd look crazy because it's just such a big deviation from the pre Obama times. What U.S. foreign policy has typically been for the last 150 years, and clearly Obama has a very different vision for the world. So another thing that I kind of find interesting is one consistent strategy by Islam, and it's how they turn a loss into a victory. And one way they do it is if they attack somebody and they lose, they sign the winner, typically showing some magnanimity, makes them sign a peace treaty, which they just disobey at the first sign of weakness of the enemy, right? And this goes back to, I think it's called the Treaty of Hudaybiyah, where they attacked Mecca. Mecca made Mohammed himself and his gang of pirates sign a peace treaty saying they wouldn't attack him for 10 years.
Right, it was a 10-year peace treaty.
And then 2 years later, they attacked and took Mecca, right? And then after they took Mecca, they marched.
It doesn't mean anything.
It does mean something, but it doesn't mean what it looks like it means, right? And then they marched back to Yathrib, which is now Medina, and they did the same thing to the people who'd given them shelter there. Which was the Jewish tribes of Banu Qurayza, I think it was, in Yathrib. And then, okay, so we can flash forward now to the first gates of Vienna in 1683, September 11, but before that they'd attacked Vienna, they'd lost. And Vienna made them sign a deal saying they wouldn't attack again for X number of years, and then they did. And they nearly won that one. And then there's the peace treaty they signed with Thomas Jefferson's Marines, where the Marines beat them right back to the coast of Tripoli in Libya, right? And they signed a peace treaty saying they wouldn't do this again, and then they waited for the first opportunity and then went back on it. So, and now we're going to see that. I think a modern instance of it we're going to see in the Philippines. You made me think of it when you mentioned the MILF, which is an unfortunately named terrorist group, the Moro Islamic Liberation Front, which is the Islamic group in the Philippines, and they just managed to get the Philippines to sign a thing giving them sovereignty over a huge chunk of one of the islands of, I think, Moro,
right, the southern Philippines.
But you're all, and so. And so the deal was, and it's the same thing they do everywhere. It's actually what Claire Lopez said when she was on our show a few weeks ago. She said, well, the terrorism is an end in itself. They terrorize you to get you to, like, give them what they want, and then they just keep doing it, right? So we're going to, and I think I've already seen since this peace treaty additional terrorist attacks on the government of the Philippines by Muslim groups in defiance of this peace treaty they signed, because why would they stop now that it's working? It's just that people need to be aware, and our leaders need to be aware of these tactics, because if history teaches us anything, it's that people don't study history.
Yeah, that's right. We have to be aware that a Western peace treaty is completely meaningless to these people, because it does not further their cause, their religion. It does not add to their religion. And if it doesn't, then they just discard it. It doesn't mean anything to them, and they can do what they want.
But what's only
this
tactical.
Is what the religion teaches them.
Yeah, like any agreement.
This is what
with an
Islam
infidel.
Teaches them.
Yes.
Sorry?
Any agreement. Yeah. Any agreement with an infidel is nothing more than a means to an end.
Right.
Right. It doesn't mean,
because that's what Muhammad did. That's what Muhammad did, and he's the model, and he is to be emulated and followed. And whatever he did, the people do, and that's exactly what he did.
Yeah, it's the great clash between barbarity and civilization, between decency and backhandedness and savagery. It's just, you look at what goes on in the Islamic world, and how can you not, if you cannot call these things savage and barbaric, then why bother having these words at all? Anyway, Jeff, Cynthia, I just want to say, I want to thank you both very much for letting me do the show with you again. I'm out of steam.
It's always a great honor and a pleasure. And, of course, Cynthia, for taking part in the show this evening. Absolutely awesome guest tonight, Cynthia. And I hope you come back and see us again, because it's been great. You're very, very
it's really
thank
nice.
You. Thank you for having me on. It's nice and talking to like-minded people. Thank you.
Yes, indeed. And I'll hopefully see you all again next Friday at 3:30 Eastern Standard Time. And with that, I got to sign off. I'm totally out of steam. Thank you so much, Jeff. It's always a pleasure to be, you know, anything I can do for the EDL, you just it's a pleasure to be able to do it.
Well, thank you, Vlad. And as I say, it's always a great, it's a great honor and privilege to always have you. You know, co-hosting on the show with me, myself, and to Cynthia tonight, once again, thank you so much. You've been a great guest, and I think everybody's been probably enthralled with the great conversations that we've had this evening. So thank you once again for your time this evening. Come back and see us again soon, Cynthia. Please do.
Thank you, I will. I just have to retrieve a sandwich now. My lucky dog.
Well, to say it's,
okay,
it's
thank
been,
you again.
You are so welcome, Cynthia. Anytime. So once again, as I say, it's been really great tonight having Cynthia coming onto the show and speaking with Vlad and myself about the Quran and the issues that we've been discussing. So there you go. Once again, I've got to thank her for being here. Guys, I've got to do something I should have done at the beginning of the show, but as I say, we were building up for having a guest on, so it's totally slipped my mind. But I need to be talking about this. In Ipswich, right, this is something we're talking to Ivan that needs to be read out, so I'm going to start reading it now. This is a Riverside View, and it's Ipswich UAF meeting greeted by EDL members, and this is one part of the thing I wanted to discuss. I've been informed that last night's Unite Against Fasi meeting held at the Unite office was met by a reception committee of at least 10 hardened EDL members who verbally intimidated and made racially abusive comments to people going into and leaving the meeting, according to my source. The group remained outside the offices chanting slogans throughout the whole meeting. As that's probably what some of the UF people wanted, I don't know why they are expressing concern. After all, what the local UF lot want to do is incite the EDL so they can have a punch-up in town sometime, after which the UF crowd will flee to the sanctuary of places like Stowmarket where they live, leaving us Ipswich people to deal with the aftermath. So there you go. Hardened EDL members, yep. Go on to the next. I think this is the first article here that I wanted to discuss. This was in response to that article, and it says, this is from Ivan actually. Dear members of Ipswich NUT and other trade unions, you have published a post saying that you are marching for multicultural integrated Ipswich against the English Defence League. In fact, the English Defence League in Ipswich and members of the town Muslim communities have beaten you to it. When the EDL marched in Ipswich following Lee Rigby's killing, Muslims took to the initiative and joined them. These were not radicalizing, anti-democratic firebrands that you seem to put on a pedestal, but rather ordinary, decent Muslims who turned out to show that their multiculturalism and patriotism can and do share the same space. Are you going to denounce these good people as fascists as you are on your march? You accuse the EDL of peddling Islamophobic and racist poison. We were distributing leaflets. Leaflets and pamphlets have been the traditional ways of disseminating ideas since Gutenberg invented the printing press. Some recipients of the leaflets will have taken one look at them and filed them in the bin. That's democracy. Others will have been set thinking by the leaflets. Whether or not you like it, that's democracy too. Democracy cannot survive unless we all accept that some people will espouse ideas that we dislike. One of two exceptionally hypocritical things about your post is that it's well known in many workplaces that some of the most racist, sexist, homophobic and yes, Islamophobic people in the place are card-carrying union members. Probably the sort who will be marching with you on 7th of July to try and divert attention to other people's perceived prejudices. The other again concerns divisionary tactics. As the spotlight shines on high-level political corruption in unions, you are trying to kid people that you are more concerned with the rights of minorities than with putting your people in Labour safe seats at the next general election. Your view of the Labour Party as your property, so it's no wonder that Labour politicians are waking up to the fact that the age of the unions as they presently exist is over. You are turning out to celebrate multicultural Islam is Ipswich on the 7th of July. So are we. The difference is we will mean it. That's East Anglian's EDL. And I've got another, I must read out before we start to close down the show. And this was, we was waiting for a response for that. also we couldn't, this other letter to the, another letter that we wrote. Dear members of the Ipswich UAF, I'm writing about your leaflets advertising your meeting about the English Defence League on the 7th of July. You say that we scapegoat Muslim people? Nothing could be further from the truth. We oppose Sharia and jihad, which arises from Sharia, from Tommy Robinson down. Our position has been that ordinary Muslim people trying to integrate are the first victims of these. If you continue to support extremists who want to mutilate girls and force them into marriages and radicalise boys and give them toxic ideas about girls, you continue to prevail to prevent the integrated multiculturalist Ipswich you say you are protecting. We in the English Defence League are multiculturalists too. We believe that everybody stands as equals in the eyes of one law of the land. If you give yourselves the right to deny that we are the multiculturalists because you disagree with some of the things we say, then it is you who are the fascists, not us. Fascists throughout history have given themselves the power to decide who is included in public life and then who is excluded. This is a defining mark of fascism. You take every opportunity you can to smear us and try to deceit violence against us, just as Hitler did with the Jews. It is you who are the fascists. I draw your attention to your leaflet for an Ipswich UAF meeting held on the 27th of June, in which you say that we hate gay people, the disabled, all immigrants and ethnic minorities, as well as socialists and those in trade unions. I'm only surprised you don't say we have horns and hooves. We have an LGBT division, a member of whom recently spoke about how the UAF in East London are cheerleading while extremists bully and beat gay people out of the area. We have disabled members and members who are immigrants, or the children of immigrants. We are lively Jewish, Sikh, Hindu, pagan, and atheist memberships, as well as a small but growing Muslim membership. As I've said before, we are multicultural. You tar us far right, but we have members from all over the political spectrum. We have a lot of members in unions, and our members have friends in unions. I think unions know this, which is doubtless why the TUC, Unite, and FCS logos, which appear on the first leaflet, do not appear on this even more hateful one entitled Fuck the Nazi EDL. Excuse me about the language there, guys. I've got to say it how it is. We do not blame all Muslims for the murder of Gunner Lee Rigby. We merely want answers from the government as to why they have not acted against the extremists who have been publicly calling for British soldiers to be beheaded, among other things, for some years now. We applaud the actions of the 500 imams who recently preached that women are not objects, a view you have denied exists within the Muslim community. You say we belong in the sewer and that we are Hitler lovers. Given Hitler's determination to conquer British forces, if we were Nazis, why then would we support the British armed forces? It seems you are merely throwing the names which causes the highest emotions in people's minds at us without being able to make any coherent argument at all. Can you make any case at all that it is us who are the fascists and not yourselves? Awaiting your reply, East Anglians, EDL. There you go, guys. I had to read it. I hope I'll give it my best. I wanted to add a bit of venom to it with the way I feel about that as well. It makes me so angry with these people, ladies and gentlemen. Anyway, let me come back into the chat. So it had to be said. It's got to be said about these people. It's that hateful thing that we had to come back hard against them because we have got members who are disabled and Sikh. And you know, people, what they talked about in that horrific way, we had to respond in kind. Yes, exactly, Julian Brown, and that's angry. Yes, I agree. But this is the kind. Oh, my goodness me. Ladies and gentlemen, I've got to say once again, it's been a very busy evening. I haven't had the chance to read down everybody in the chat room this evening. But as I say, we've had Vlad Tepes, and we've had Barbara. Barbara, it's always pleasure to see you. Darren Walsh, always pleasure, bruh. Drake Strum. East Anglian Princess. Jenny, always a pleasure to see you. You work so hard in the background as well. Frank GA, always a pleasure to see you. We've got numerous guests. Of course, we've got Golf Dogs. Also a pleasure to see you, brother. And, of course, we've got our own Holger Waits with his own great show and his great blog there. And, of course, we've got our very own Ivan Humble. Thank you, my brother, for reminding me to... what I had to do at the end of the show. So I'd like to thank you all once again for tuning in to the East Anglians EDL radio show tonight. Thank you so much for being in the chat room and supporting the show as you do. And not forgetting you, the great listening audience out there, guys. As we all say, if there wasn't you, for you, there wouldn't be enough. So thank you for your continuing support. And we'll be back again this Sunday. So for myself and, of course, from Vlad, from all Team EDL, Team East Angus EDL and all of us, good night, take care, stay safe. And as I say, we'll see you again this Sunday. God bless you all, guys. Here we go. We're going underground, guys. And not forgetting, no surrender. No surrender ever, guys. Here we go.
might need some tension to relax me. I'm too busy dodging through your facts. Here's what you get. You made your bed, you better lie in it. You choose your lead and the place you're trapped. And the lies will shut down and their promises come. You'll be killing machines with paper rockets and guns. And the public wants what the public gets. But I don't get what the society wants.
Just gone into the archives. So, as I say, it was. It's been a very busy night tonight. A great guest that we had call in, and of course our other calls. So, so we'll be back again this Sunday. But I'll play a couple of things before in the archive before we wind the show right down there. So, thanks for listening to the archives this evening, and we'll play a tune that. We must resist, guys. We must resist. Here we go. Of course, Alex and the Bandits.
News of the world said we are hooligans. We're the only people to defend your rights. And I won't stand by and watch this country die. Roll Britannia with the EDL. Go mental! We're the best.
Alex and the Bandits, We Must Resist. And I'm going to go straight into this one. Before I do, as I say, I'm normally thinking about our boys and girls that's over in Afghanistan at this moment in time. It's probably just getting up. It's just about to go and do their duty, like they do. Sometimes in very dangerous conditions. So I always think of I think of them most of the time, but, you know, this time of the evening, I'm thinking they're just getting up and ready to go doing their duty. And I mean all of our, you know, all of our allies troops that's out there, you know, Canadians, Americans, all of us, you know, and also my thoughts go out to them, who's out overseas at this moment. So I'm thinking of the families as well. So anyway, if you are listening, guys, I know sometimes you have to pick it up with the internet radio as it is. You know, we're all thinking of you guys, so you keep safe and that, and hope to see you back home soon, guys. So, and girls, don't forget the girls as well. You know, we've got a lot of good ladies out there as well. So, thinking of you all as well, guys. And there you go. But what I'm going to do, I'm going to point a finger once again at our spineless politicians that we've got out there. And this tune, if you're listening, any of you listening to this tune, think about the words. Think about these words, you know. You might think, you're only working class people. Well, look what happens around the world. You know, think about it. Anyway, this is called by the Dubliners, an England scorned. So think about this. Here we go.
You sit there in your shirt and tie, boldly dictating a crooked smile while you fed us lies. You didn't trust your own persuading. You sought to slay and to keep at bay the few good men that warned. While the dawn is nigh, look to the sky, beware of an England scorned. All that I, the riddle I die, for the riddle I. You were bought with coin and you played your part and you'll live through the day. You smite the ways of our hallowed land and ignore the plight of our people, while you grease the stranger's outstretched hand and shout that all are equal. There'll be bitter cries for your deeds and lies when Willard sounds the horn. And the Norns will glide through English sky and you'll reap an England scorned.
Your part and your lips through the day.
to me, Father, of a little I die. Hark to the sound it holds. When freedom cries, fill English skies, you'll wish you'd never been born.
Say goodnight to you all who's been listening there into the archives this evening. I think this is the right one. Wins, is this it? Yeah, I think so. Anyway, guys, once again, I'd like to thank you all for tuning in to the East Anglian's EDL radio show tonight, official English Defence League's radio station. And so we'll be back again this Sunday. Once again, another great show for you guys. So, thank you so much for supporting the show as what you do. So for myself, Jeff, no surrender, EDL. This is my exit tune for the evening. So good night, guys. Take care, stay safe. God bless you all, and not forgetting, no surrender. So wins a change.
Feel it everywhere. I'm blowing with the wind. from up here.